So this is volume 8, and we're beginning with November the 3rd, 1907. And the heading is that the soul in the divine will must concur in everything. In other words, if we are letting the divine will take over from our human will, then it is what the divine will wants that actually has to happen, not what we want, and we cannot impose our will on his. That would be a contradiction in terms. So Louisa says, this morning, as I was in my usual state, I felt Jesus move in my interior, repeating, let us go higher. What do you mean higher? Remember the eagle, won't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is volume 8, and he's already said in an earlier volume that he wants us to fly high like eagles. I don't give you the image of the eagle for nothing. So the eagle is the one that flies higher and higher. So on hearing this, I shrugged my shoulders, saying, Lord, what do you say? Let us go higher. So it might be any harm to write eagle there, and then you'll remember what references you look up. Mm-hmm. Okay. Say rather, I will go higher with chastisements. I'm afraid to put my will into it. And he said, my daughter, my will and yours are one. Now, they're either one or they're not. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if the Lord decides on chastisements, a chastisement is a severe mercy to try and save the soul at the price of the body suffering a little. So that's like a doctor saying, you know, if I do this operation on you, you'll have a future. My daughter, he said, my will and yours are one. And if I say, let us go higher with chastisements, do I not say the same in good, the good that I do to creatures, which surpasses, oh, by far, the chastisements? Also, are you not united with me in the many other chastisements which I do not send? You see, Louisa only looks at one side of the thing. She doesn't look at the fact that the Lord sometimes cuts the chastisements down by one third because of her prayers and reparations. And she doesn't look at that at all. And the enormity of it, one person getting such a response from the Lord. Okay. So one who is united in good, should he not be united in mortifications? Between me and you, there must be no division. You are nothing but a tiny little grass. Now, that's much bigger than he usually says she is. He has told her before that she's an atom. So if you're a blade of grass, you're much bigger than that now. You're nothing, only a tiny little blade of grass, which God delighted in endowing with a marvellous virtue. And just as one who does not know the virtue that this tiny little grass contains tramples on it and does not even look at it, in the same way, one who does not know the gift of the divine will understood, which I have placed in you, and the power which my little grass contains, and I'm now using virtue in the other sense, because most frequently the word virtue in these writings means power. And the power which my little grass contains not only tramples you, but does not understand how I delight in giving value to the littlest things. Now, he keeps on telling us that even our smallest actions are very important if they're done in the divine will. So after this, he seemed to lean his head upon mine, and I said, oh, please let me feel your thorns. And he said, do you want me to beat you? And Louisa said, yes. I don't know what you would say. I know what I would say. At that moment, a rod armed with balls of fire found itself in the hands of Jesus. Now, it wasn't a rope or anything. It wasn't a little stick. It was a rod armed with balls of fire. Found itself into the hand of Jesus. And I, seeing the fire, said, Lord, I'm afraid of fire. Beat me with the rod. And he said, you don't want to be beaten, I'm going away. In other words, the problem is her will or his. Mm. That's what he's actually testing. Right. Yeah. He says, do you want? She says, yes. So it would appear that her will is totally conformed to his. Then he shows her what he wants to beat her with. And then she says, oh, no, excuse me. Now, this teaching is not given to Louisa for Louisa. It's given to Louisa for us. Mm-hmm. Because we don't realise that we say to the Lord, yes, I'll have your divine will, and a second later you say, oh, but on these conditions. or, you know, at this time, or in other words, we actually change it to our own will.
I'm not ready yet.
Yeah, exactly. He said, you don't want to be beaten, so I'm going away. And he disappeared without giving me the time to pray him to beat me as he pleased. In other words, by the time she got around to saying, you know, the way you want it. Oh, how concerned and afflicted I remained, but he who is so good will forgive me. Okay, so we have a very important one coming up November the 18th, 1907. And this is about our nothingness. Okay, so it is very important to underline this, because if we don't get into nothingness, we're not going anywhere. By living her nothingness, the soul is filled with God. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. So, Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little. And as soon as I saw him, I said, my sweet life, how bad I have become. I feel I am reduced to nothing. Now, how can you be reduced to nothing if you're nothing anyway? I no longer feel anything in me. Everything is empty. I just feel an enchantment in my interior. And in this enchantment, I wait for you. So this is the attraction she has for the Lord, so that you may fill me. Now notice empty and fill. See the two? Okay, I'm just pointing out so that you can show others how to get the juice out of these texts. But in vain do I wait for this filling. On the contrary, I feel I always return to nothing. And Jesus said, ah, my daughter, and you afflict yourself, for you feel reduced to nothing. Rather, I say to you, the more the creature is reduced to nothing, the more she is filled with the all. Now, there's your prevenient prayer. My nothingness in your allness. Okay. And if she left even one shadow of herself, that shadow would prevent me from giving all of myself. Now, here you're being shown quite clearly that if we only give two-thirds of ourselves, there's only room for two-thirds of him. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so if we're not experiencing all of him, the problem is entirely on our side. So I can't give myself completely to your soul. Your constant returning to nothing means that you are dissolving your human being to reacquire the divine. Now, if you have a colored pencil, that's where you use it, because that's the gem. Okay? Your constant returning to nothing means that you are dissolving your human being to reacquire the divine. I would suggest, as often as you can remember it, to say, Lord, I'm throwing my nothingness into your allness. To try and say that as often as you can until you get into the habit of being aware of your nothing and that he is your all. So November the 21st, 1907, we come back to the subject of love, because the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. God is love. So the heading given to us is love and union between the creator and the creature. So, continuing in my usual state, Louisa said, I was uniting myself with our Lord, making his thought, his heartbeat, his breath, and all of his movements one with mine. And then, adding the intention, now notice the importance of the intention, okay? Adding the intention of going to all creatures, to give this to them all. So first of all, she unites all of herself with all of him to take all of this to everybody else. That's right. So you put your little word fusing at the side there. Okay. And she has just different ways of saying it. Okay. And the different ways of saying it actually illuminates the whole process. And the idea is to help every soul, past, mm-hmm. present and future. And since I was united to Jesus in the Garden of Olives, I also gave to all and to each one. Now, she says all and each one to make sure that you hear that when you say the 7 billion on the planet, that you mean every single person, not just some kind of shadowy photograph of a crowd, that is given to everyone individually. So it's given to all and to each one, and also to the purging souls, the drops of his blood, his prayers, his pains, and all the good he did. Now, again, that's something that needs to be done frequently, is that you enter into him and take his precious blood, make it your own, and take it to the holy souls in purgatory and to the dying, the two groups that need it with the greatest speed, and then take it to everybody else. So that all the breaths, movements and heartbeats of creatures might be repaired, purified and divinized. Now, can't you see that that's the perfect way to pray for anybody? And I gave the fount of all goods, which are his pains, as remedies for all. While I was doing this, blessed Jesus told me in my interior, my daughter, with these intentions of yours, you wound me. That means you touch me deeply. You touch me deeply continuously. And since you do them often, you see, look at the little often. In the early days, people, you know, have asked me, well, how often would I have to do that? I mean, do you only do that once a day kind of stuff? And we don't realise that if you take one drop of water out of the ocean, it's not a big impression, is it? No, you need an awful lot of drops out of the ocean to make an impression. So these acts have got to be done continuously. How do you do them continuously? Okay, so we start at 7:15 in the evening and we start fusing, and we're going to do it continuously to 20 past, to 25 past, to 8:30, to 20 to 8, to 20 to 8, to 7:45. Is that what you mean?
All the intentions.
Tell me how you do that.
All the intentions of the next 24 hours. Fuse them to the Lord.
No, that's the beginning of the day. You have it.
The intention.
You place the intention. You remember at 7:15. Ah, Lord, I place the intention for the rest of the evening. And when I remember at 8:00, I place the intention for the rest of the evening. When I remember going to bed, I place the intention for the rest of the night. Because you have to give your attention to other things that you're doing. Okay. So you can't be doing it at every instant without, unless you do it with the intention. Okay. So that's how you do it continuously. And since you do them often, one arrow does not wait for another, and I'm always deeply touched again. And Louisa said, how can it be possible that you are deeply touched when you hide and you make me suffer so much in waiting for your coming? She never lets him off the hook on that one. Are these the wounds or the touches? Is this the love that you have for me? Now, he has explained it to her endlessly why he doesn't come. But one of the things she should have known anyway is in the scriptures, the just man lives by faith, not by sight. Do you remember what Jesus said to Thomas after the resurrection? Thomas, you believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who have not seen and believe. Okay, so Louisa has to live that way as well, even though she's incredibly privileged. So Jesus said, rather, I've said nothing of all that I should say to you. The soul herself, while she is a pilgrim, cannot understand all the good and all the love that passes between the creatures and creators. In other words, our intellect, bound in flesh as it is during our earthly pilgrimage, cannot grasp it. Because you often hear Louisa saying, when she's in an out-of-the-body experience, she understands things very well. She comes back into the body and then she doesn't understand them. That's because of the effect that the flesh has on us. Okay. And in, I think it's in volume 24, Jesus says that most human beings will never comprehend what he's telling us about the divine will before they die. They just try and say yes and enter into it as much as they can. But understanding it, you'll have it only on the other side. That is understanding it at the level that it needs to be understood. So that her operating, that's her working, speaking, suffering is all in my life. If you're in the divine will, everything you do is in the divine or at the divine level or divinized, whichever way you want to say it. And that only by acting in this way can she do good for all. It's only at the divine level that we can affect all souls, past, present and future. At the human level, absolutely no. I will just tell you that each thought, each heartbeat and movement of yours, each member of yours, That means each part of your body. Any suffering bone of yours are as many lights that come out from you. Now, I want to give you Matthew 5, 14 to 16. You are the light of the world. And as they touch me, I melt them for the good of all, while I send back to you tripled as many other lights of grace. Now, notice lights of grace. You know from volume 2 that Jesus said, I am grace. Okay. Jesus also said, I am the light of the world. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. So lights of grace means more outpourings of God into us. And in heaven, I will give them to you in of glory. So it's of grace while we're on the earth. And when you go to heaven, then it's no longer of grace because the days of grace are over. And then it's of glory. It is enough to tell you that there is such union, such closeness, that the creator is the organ and the creature the sound. Now, notice whose will is operating. Okay. The creator is the sun and the creature the rays. Now, notice who is the source of light. The creator is the flower and the creature is the fragrance. Who is the substance? Okay. Can one perhaps be without the other? So for that, I want to give you Galatians 2:20. I no longer live. Christ lives in me. Galatians 2:20. So he says, no, we cannot be without one another at this stage. Do you think that I do not take into account all your interior work and your pains? How can I forget them if they come from my very self? They're sourced in him. Okay, if he's the flower and she's the fragrance, they're coming from himself. If he's the sun and she's the rays, it's coming from him. Is that okay? And they are one thing. In other words, there's complete union between you and me. I also add that every time my passion is remembered, since it is a treasure exposed for the good of all, it is as if one put it on a counter to multiply it and distribute it for the good of all. Look at that for doing your hours. Isn't that lovely? Okay. So November the 23rd, 1907 is another VIP message, and it's about discernment. Okay. What I'm doing right now is I'm just preparing to do a whole lot of research on different subjects for us to study new subjects, like discernment will be one of them. So I stick discernment at the top, and you'll know that it's in this particular text. I stuck love at the top of the last one, you know what I mean, so that we will have the different subjects and we'll know exactly where to find them. So this one's about discernment. If the soul suffers distractions at communion, oh gosh, that's never happened to you, has it? It is a sign that she's not given herself completely to God. Yeah, we'd know that anyway, wouldn't we? Yeah, but you can suffer distractions inside of yourself and you can suffer distractions outside of yourself. If they're singing a completely inappropriate hymn, I think that's a major distraction. I don't know what you do, but I stick my fingers in my ears so that I can concentrate on what's going on in the inside. So having heard from someone that she would get easily distracted at communion, Louisa said, I was saying in my interior, how is it possible to get distracted while being with you? Now, not at the level that Louisa's at. Now, I mean, she's Mount Everest and I'm on the ground, okay? So she doesn't understand how you would get distracted. At the top of Mount Everest, there's nothing to distract you. But at ground level, there's a good bit. Okay. So she doesn't realise where the rest of us are. Does one perhaps not remain all absorbed in you? That's what we would like. Now, finding myself in my usual state, I was doing my usual interior things, and it was as if I could see some distractions wanting to enter into me. Notice that wanting to enter. Look how much control of her thoughts she has. Okay. Now, I want to give you, for the control of the thoughts, 2 Corinthians 10:5, where Paul says, every thought has got to be captured and given to Christ. Now, that's a good one for Lent. And if you think it's easy, just try it. And you'll be amazed at how many thoughts you have to capture. Those distractions wanting to enter into me, and blessed Jesus put his hands in front of them and didn't let them in. Why? Because her will is completely united with his, so he protects her. Then he told me, my daughter, if the soul suffers distractions and disturbances, now how can you have a disturbance at communion? In case you don't think about it immediately, I'll give you an example and then you'll have loads of them. I know people who let themselves be utterly disturbed by the way people dress going up to communion, by the way people walk going up to communion, by whether they stand or kneel or put their hand out or their tongue out or whatever it is, and they have themselves completely disturbed and they seem to be not aware of who they are receiving. They're only aware of rules and regulations that they think are important. Does that make any sense to you? That's a huge distraction nowadays. And what are they doing? They actually enter into judgment and everything. I think I told you the story about a friend of mine who was going up to communion one day in a public church in Ireland. A big long queue. You know, in those days, everybody tumbled out of the seats all at the same time as if the priest wasn't going to wait for you. And so there she was, and she had plenty of time to get to the top. And the Lord said, sit down. I want to talk to you. She sat down and she said, Lord, what have I done? He said, you hate somebody I love. She said, I do not. So he dangled in front of her a picture of a certain person. And it was a lady. And she said, ah, but that's only a politician. And Jesus said, I died for that person. Do you mind? Don't you dare receive me without coming back to me, loving your neighbour and having apologised. What do you think of that? You see, we allow ourselves thoughts that, you know, we say are fine because we're using the world's standard. We're not using the Lord's standard.
But something that's why you have a difference with your brother. Go away from the altar before you offer your offering.
That's all. If they did that, there'd be nobody at Mass. So I know of a case where that actually happened and they ended up writing a book about it because the entire congregation was reconciled. But it didn't happen in Ireland. So here's the Lord saying, if the soul suffers distractions and disturbances, it is a sign that she has not given herself completely to me. But you may have given yourself to rules and regulations about what's right or wrong. In fact, when the soul has given herself completely to me, since she is my own thing, because he is the creator and we're the creature, I know how to keep my gift in good custody. So here he's protecting Louisa. And when they do not give me everything because of their free will, I cannot keep that special custody, and they are forced to suffer importuning things which disturb my union with them. So can you imagine somebody walking up to communion and they're judging people around them as to right or wrong or good or bad or whatever? Are they in a correct disposition to receive the Lord?
No.
No. Is their disposition love? The answer is no. And they're receiving eternal love. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge contradiction between the heart that is reaching out to receive and the heart that wants to come. And so you can end up actually disturbed, upset, and wonder what on earth is wrong with you because you were in good humour when you came into the church. And now you're receiving communion and you're no longer in good humour, but you don't realise that you caused the problem, you know. He said, on the other hand, when the soul is all mine, she makes no effort to remain calm. The commitment is all mine and to let nothing enter to disturb our union. In other words, if you really give yourself to me, I'll see to it. I'll look after it. That's not bad, is it? So, December 1907, here's your heading for this one, the intention. Now, you can help me with my research, okay? And this is a very important one as well. So you'll notice that these messages are given, but there's a core thing that he's trying to put across, okay? So Louisa said, I was in my usual state. I found myself with the thought that Blessed Jesus met his Blessed Mother on the way to Calvary. And while I was sympathizing both with one and the other, Blessed Jesus said, my daughter, my mother went out on the day of my passion only to be able to meet and relieve her son. It was her only intention, okay? In the same way, for a truly loving soul, her intention, notice the intention, is in all of her actions is only that of encountering her beloved and of relieving him. So there's somebody who is seriously living divine will, and the concentration is on the loving the Lord. So we try to relieve him from the weight of the cross. And since human life is a continuous attitude of actions, both external and internal, the soul does nothing but meet her beloved, either in her neighbour or in herself. And will she just meet him? No, no. She will greet him, she will embrace him, she kisses him, she consoles him, she loves him, be it even by a little word said in passing. And he will be satisfied and content. And since the action always contains a sacrifice, if the action is done to encounter the sacrifice contained in it, it will serve to relieve me from the weight of my cross. What will be the happiness of this soul who, in her actions, is always in contact with me? What you'll notice is, I'm sure you have this as your own testimony, that when you're trying to live in communion with the Lord all the time, that you're actually content. And you find other people and they're discontent about this and that and the other, and they've got problems with everybody, from the politicians down, you know, and everybody's out of step except my Johnny, and they don't know why they're unhappy. It's amazing. And sometimes you know, might even say, well, what are you smiling about? You know, and if you tried to tell them, they wouldn't be able to hear it. Because yeah, I remember a woman actually saying to me once, I never met her before, where do you get that peace from? And instead of telling her where I got it from, I said, do you want it? Because she looked very unpeaceful to me. And she said, yeah, I'd love it. I said, it's very expensive. Are you willing to pay for it? She said, what do you mean? I said, you know, it takes repentance and getting rid of your old selfishness and your old sins and things like that and all the rest. I said, it's quite expensive, but it's worth it. And in spite of herself, she got more and more interested. She said, I shouldn't be listening to you, she said. And I said, you are, because the Lord's talking to you. It isn't just me. And took her by the hand and took her to confession. Because I said, this is the peace box, I said. I said, do you see it? It's called a peace box. That's where you'll get sorted. But I knew what particular confession I was taking her to and what particular priest, so it was okay. So you're always in contact with me, and therefore you have this peace. Now, one of the signs given, this is volume 8, one of the signs given through all of the volumes for someone walking in divine will successfully is the peace that passes all understanding. That's Philippians 4:7. Okay. So you'll have this peace. And he tells us that the peace has got to go deeper and deeper and deeper. So what will be the happiness of the soul who in all her actions is always in contact with me? How my love will grow ever more at each additional encounter. We would say at each act, okay, that she has by means of her acting with me. So each one of our acts is an encounter with him. And he says you grow with each one of them. And how few are those who make use of it to find the shortest way in which their actions come to me, cling to me and relieve me from the many afflictions that creatures give me. So he's saying it's not difficult, but it is costly. OK. So January the 23rd, 1908, Jesus never goes to the soul uselessly. Now, then it says, temporizing. That's not a word we usually use. Rationalizing. Will you put the word rationalizing over it? Because rationalizing is a word we use. Rationalizing gives time and space for the enemies to wage battle. And rationalism is one of the scourges in the church since about the 1940s, around the time that some of us were coming onto the planet. So Louisa says, as M came. Now that M represents Monsignor, and she calls the bishop Monsignor. Okay. So as Monsignor came, he told me that in these comings of our Lord, I did not deserve anything, and that I only deserved something when I practiced the virtues. Now, who's telling something wrong? In other words, you've got to pay for it. You've got to deserve it. It isn't pure grace. It isn't pure gift. And he told me to pray for certain needs of his. Then, during the course of the day, I was concerned about what I had heard. And in order to snap out of it, I said to myself, my adorable good, you know that I have never cared about merits, but only about loving you. Now, this is 1908. So when you come across something like this, you have to remember what year it is. Because in those early days in the 20th century, there was a thing in the church that you were supposed to get more and more merits. So you pay for a mass and you get 300 days indulgence. That's the merits you get. Mm-hmm. And you can apply it to the souls in purgatory. If you do an act of charity, that could be 500 days or whatever. These are the merits. And it really got stuck in religious life in a terrible way. St. Therese of Lisieux is the first saint I know who said, no way, no way. I'm not going to look at merits. I don't want to know. Mm. And Therese is just the first one I know. It's just that I don't know all the others. That she said, no, Lord, I will only love you. I don't care about merits. And if there are merits, it's your problem. You can deal with it. Okay. But it was very prevalent. And here's the bishop telling her she needs to get her merits. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So if there's a problem in the church, it will be widespread. Okay. So she said to the Lord, look, I've never cared about merits, but only by loving you. That's exactly the same position as St. Therese. It seemed that they want to make me a servant in your house. Okay. In other words, that I have to be paid for being good. So you pay servants. You don't pay the children. They want me to be a servant. Now, if Louisa was to be reduced to a servant, she would lose all the privileges she has and she'd lose this incredible union she has with others. I remember a couple of years ago coming across a thing on YouTube. You know, you come across some of these things by accident. And it was someone from one of the Protestant denominations claiming that they had had a visit, they visited heaven. And I thought, well, that'd be interesting to see what they say about heaven, you see. And I came away with not remembering one iota she said about heaven. The only thing I remembered was that God said to her, my servant this, my servant that, my servant. I said, Lord, I don't want to be your servant. I want to be your child. And this was given on the internet as if it was something brilliant. But if God calls you a servant, you're at a terrible distance from him. Terrible distance. That's the only reason why I want to say it here. And Jesus is going to bring this up many times in these writings, that a person living in the divine will is a person who is baptized in the ordinary way, first of all, and you're living ordinary Christian life. You're an adopted child of God. OK, when you come into divine will, there's a certain point at which the two wills actually clinch. And Jesus says it's another baptism. And you become a genuine child of God, not an adopted child of God. You become family. And you'll hear him talking about this more and more and more as you go on. So to be reduced to a servant would be the prodigal son. Do you remember?
Yeah.
He said, let me be a servant, no longer a son. So that would be a terrible thing. So just put CF Luke 15 there. So you know that it's a reduction of status to go from son to servant. So it seems they want to make me a servant in your house as if I cared about gains. No, I don't want to be a servant, but a daughter. Do you see that I want to be the true child? Even more, you are my beloved and I yours. Now, that's straight out of the Song of Songs. My beloved is mine and I am his. But in spite of this, that thought would come back to me often. In other words, it lodged in her brain. And now as I found myself in my usual state, my blessed Jesus came and told me, my daughter, Monsignor did not tell you the truth. Will you please underline it? That's why I pointed it out to you at the beginning. Even bishops can make mistakes. All he's doing is passing on the stuff that's going around the church. He hasn't thought it through. He didn't tell you the truth because when I go to a soul, I never go uselessly and I always bring her some usefulness. I speak to her and I knock out all the nows, okay. I speak to her about virtues, or I correct her, or I communicate my beauty to her in such a way that all other things appear ugly to her, and many other things. And even if I did not say anything to her, it is certain that love develops more in the soul, and the more she loves me, the more I come to love her in return. And the merits of love are so great, so noble and so divine that compared to other merits, these could be called lead as distinct from gold. So I have to give you all the love references again. OK, John 14:23. John 15:9. John 13:34-35. John 13:34-35, 1 Corinthians 14:1, Ephesians 3:16-21. You'd know them off by heart yet. Now, and I haven't even given them all to you. There's others as well. So notice that looking for merits is just lead, as distinct from pure gold. Besides, he himself came. And indeed, he did not come like a statue. He tried to say, he himself now is the Monsignor. Okay. He didn't come like a statue. He tried to say some words and to do you some good, though as a creature, underline. He didn't come to you spiritually. And then I, who am the creator, you mean that I would do useless things? At that moment, I remembered the needs of that Monsignor told me, and I prayed the Lord to answer him. In the meantime, I seemed to see him with a silver-coloured garment, a black veil descended from his head, covering part of his eyes, and this veil seemed to communicate itself to another person who was behind him. I couldn't understand anything of this, and blessed Jesus told me, the silver-coloured garment that you see on him is his purity in operating. In other words, his intentions are right. Okay? And the black veil is the human that he mixes with it. Ta-da! Mm-hmm. He has the right intention, but unfortunately he's mixing the human stuff. Now, go back a couple of lines, and it said that this black veil covered part of his eyes. That prevents him from seeing properly. Now, you notice that all the human stuff prevents you from being able to see properly. This human that he mixes is like a veil which covering the light of truth. Now, where did he make a mistake? On truth, didn't he? Okay. Covering the light of truth that shines in his mind. Sometimes make him act out of fear or to content somebody else and not according to the truth that my grace makes shine in his mind. Now, I've just remembered, I think this is John. No, I think it's John 5. It's towards the end of John 5. I couldn't give you the verse. Jesus says, you look to one another for approval, and therefore you don't look to God for approval. And so you miss everything. You get lost. So if he's acting out of fear or to content somebody else, it's this human approval he's falling for. Yeah. It must have been rather interesting for the priest to take back that message to him. Because she sent all her messages to the priest. The priest sends it back to him. So Louisa said, "Lord, grant him what he told me, for it is something that regards your glory very much." And the Lord said, "For an irresolute soul," da-da. So you're yes and no and yes and no. "Temporizing gives time and space to the enemies to wage battle. While by not giving them time and by showing oneself resolute and unshakable, the doors are closed to the enemies and one has the good of not even exposing oneself to the brawl." So the Lord is trying to show the bishop there how to protect himself. Okay. So if he wants to reach the goal quickly, these are the means, and I will be with him and he will be victorious. And then the very ones who are most opposed to him will be the most supportive, because human beings are like that, aren't they? They back a winning horse, don't they? Not the one in the race. They will be the most supportive and they will admire him the most, seeing that he has undone their human views. In other words, he's acted from a supernatural position. Okay. That's rather interesting, showing that the bishop could make that mistake simply because he was only dealing with something on a purely human level. It's sad. But of course, they're all human, you know. So February the 6th, 1908, we're down to, back to discernment again. So put discernment there. The signs to know whether a soul is in grace. That's a very important one, isn't it? Louisa said, "As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little and told me, 'My daughter, the sign whereby to know whether a soul is in my grace is that as my grace communicates to her, the soul is ready to execute what God wants.'" In other words, you're ready to obey what the Lord wants. "In such a way that the grace which was already in her interior and that which communicates itself afterwards hold hands." Now, the church talks about a prevenient grace, the grace that goes before to prepare you. And then this is the grace that comes after. So before, middle, center and after. The grace is helping you all the way. So they all hold hands, united with the will of the soul. They place themselves in the attitude of operating. If then she's not ready, there is much to doubt about. Grace is symbolized by an electric current. Now, I would never have thought of that myself, but this is 1908. Electricity has just been discovered. And so the Lord uses examples, and he will talk. He'll use the example of a car later on when the cars turn off as well.
Of the time.
Yeah. So grace is symbolized by an electric current which turns on only those things where preparations have been made to receive the electric current. That's funny. What he's saying is, if the house isn't wired, forget about it. You can't have it. And if there isn't a socket there, there's nothing to plug in. And so he's saying exactly that thing about grace as well. We have to be disposed. We have to be open. We have to be ready. And we have to receive. Isn't it incredible how much he can say with so little?
Yes.
But where these preparations are not present, some wires are broken or consumed. Even though there is current, the light cannot come. Very interesting. I love when he picks up something contemporary. So February the 7th, 1908. "Life is a weight that will turn into treasure." It's very interesting now. "Continuing in my usual state, I was thinking about the enormous weight that blessed Jesus felt in carrying the cross. And I said to myself, 'Lord, life too is a weight. But what a weight, especially because you, my highest good, are far away.'" Okay. He came and he told me, my daughter, it's true that life is a weight. But when this weight is carried by me, do you remember the story of footprints?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right, footprints on the side there, just to remind yourself. That's the soul being carried. But when this weight is carried by me and one finds out at the end of life, he can unload this weight onto me. That's Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Come to me, all you who labour. Do you remember? Matthew 11, 28 to 30. And at the end of life, that he can unload this weight within me, he will find this weight changed into a treasure, in which he will find gems, precious stones, diamonds, and all riches, such as to make him happy for eternity. That's very interesting, isn't it? So I want to give you Hebrews 12, 1. H-E-B, Hebrews. Matthew 7, 25, by their fruits you will know them. And 2 Corinthians 4, 17. So he's saying, yeah, you can experience life as a weight, but if you learn how to give it to the Lord and carry the cross with him, and especially if you live in the divine will, that you'll find that it is worth much more than you could ever imagine. So February the 9th, 1908, I want to give you a heading for this one as well, How to Do Divine Will Acts. Because he's going to tell us step by step how to do it. So, having received communion, Louisa said, I was saying, Lord, keep me always clasped to you. Now, we would say fused with you. So, use your word fuse, okay? For I am too little. And if you do not keep me clasped because I am little, I will get lost. He said, I want to teach you the way that you must be with me. In other words, this is how to do it, how to enter into it. First, number one, you must enter into me, transform yourself in me, and take what you find in me. Now you know where the little book got it, don't you? Okay. First of all, you must enter into me, transform yourself in me, and take what you find in me. Number two, once you have filled yourself completely with me, go out and operate together with me. Now notice, you first of all, fill yourself with him. Then you go out and work with him, as if you and I were one single thing, in such a way that if I move, you move as well. If I think, you think of the same thing of which I'm thinking. In sum, whatever I do, you do as well. So in many of the books and pamphlets you've read on divine will, you know, that you're eating with the Lord and sleeping with the Lord and working with the Lord and speaking with the Lord and all the rest of it. So number three, with these acts that we have done together, move away from me for one instant and go into the midst of creatures, giving to all and to each one. Now notice again the emphasis that it's individual. Everything that we have done together, that is, giving my divine life to each one. And then you quickly return to me and give to me in the name of all, this is number four, all the glory that they should give me, praying, excusing them, repairing and loving. Ah, yes, he said, love me for all, satiate me with love. Why? Because he is love. 1 John 4, 7. There are no passions in me, but if there could be a passion, it would only be this, love. But love in me is more than a passion, it is my life. And if passions can be destroyed, life cannot, because God is. So see the necessity of being loved, which I find myself in. Therefore, love me, love me. So that's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. And John 14, verses 15 and 23. So now we go on to February the 12th, 1908. In one day, a courageous soul does more than a timid one does in a year. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Okay. So, as I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, timidity represses grace and hampers the soul. Now, I want to give you 2 Timothy 1:7, where Paul tells Timothy that the grace that's been given to you is not timidity, but it's power and self-control and all the other things, okay? Timidity represses grace and hampers the soul, and that's because you're not allowing yourself to move, to act, to action things. A timid soul will never be good at operating great things, either for God or for her neighbour or for herself. Let's give an example. Take, for example, we ask you to share something in divine will with somebody. You say, oh, no, I couldn't do that. But you've done the preparation and you've done the prayer. Okay, so what's stopping you? A refusal to step out and walk on water. And you can't walk on water unless you take the step. Can you? No. Can you ever go out and have an effect on somebody else by giving them this message if you won't actually open your mouth to them? You can't. And so the timid soul will hold back and say, oh, no, that's not me. So you see why we've been training you to move forward and to step out, regardless of what you think about yourself. That's nothing. It's to give the Lord a chance to let you have this spiritual courage. Okay. So he says a timid soul will never be good at operating great things, either for God or for her neighbour or even for herself. When a soul is timid, it is as if she had her legs tied. Isn't that interesting? Unable to walk freely, she always has her eyes fixed on herself, naturally, because she's wondering what the feet are going to do, and on the effort she makes in order to walk. Timidity makes her keep her eyes low, never high. Now, the eagle flies high and looks to heaven, okay? In operating, she draws her strength not from God, but from herself. So I want to give you Proverbs 3:5. My son, lean not on your own understanding, okay? So notice all the emphasis in timidity is on yourself, okay? And therefore, instead of becoming stronger, she actually becomes weaker. If grace sows, it happens as to a poor farmer who, having sown and worked his little field, he harvests little or nothing. On the other hand, in one day, a courageous soul can do more than a timid one in a year. That's the Philippians 4:13. I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. I can do nothing by myself. Is that okay? So I also want to give you Deuteronomy 31, verses 6-7. That's Deuteronomy 31, verses 6-7. And I want to also give you Colossians 3, verses 1-17, where Paul is teaching the same thing as you're reading here about courage.
Colossians 3,
verses 1-17. That's most of chapter 1. So February the 16th, 1908, we're back to discernment. Put the title up now. Notice how important discernment is tonight. How the cross is the surest sign to know whether we love the Lord or not. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I was thinking about why it is that the cross alone makes us know whether we really love the Lord. While there are many other things like the virtues, prayer, the sacraments, which could make us know whether we love the Lord. And while I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus came and he said, my daughter, it is really so. The cross alone is that which makes one know whether he really loves the Lord, because a cross carried with patience and resignation, because where there is patience and resignation in crosses, there is divine life. That's why the church reveres all those wonderful people who go to Lourdes year after year, and they've been lying on a bed the whole year, and they're as patient and they're as calm and serene, and often they're more happy than the people who are well. That's the incredible bit. So if they accept the cross with patience and resignation, there is divine life. Since nature is so reluctant to suffer, If there is patience, it cannot be something natural. It has to be divine. And the soul no longer loves the Lord with her own love, but united with the love of the divine love. So the person is raised to love God at a divine level, not just at a human level. So what doubt can she have whether she loves or not if she arrives at loving him with his own love? And sometimes, you know, people who have served the sick in Lourdes have said that they have gained more by looking after the sick than the sick gained from them. On the other hand, Jesus said, in other things and even in the very sacraments, there also may be someone who loves, who contains this divine life within himself. But these things cannot give the certainty that the cross can give. It may be there or it may not because of the lack of disposition. One can very well go to confession, but if he lacks the dispositions, it certainly cannot be said that he loves and that he has received this divine life within himself. Another may go to receive communion. Indeed, he receives the divine life, but he can only say that this divine life remains within him if he had the true dispositions. Look at what I've just read. It's quite scary. Are you sure? Okay. 1 Corinthians 11, 27 to 32. Where Paul speaks about receiving Holy Communion either with or without grace.
Sorry, Francis, could you repeat that? 1 Corinthians
11, 27 to 32. So notice the sacraments depend on dispositions, but the cross is working deep within your spirit, and the cross is transforming you bit by bit and has a permanent effect. So that's why the Lord is saying that the cross is a much better thermometer to use than the reception of the sacraments. In fact, it can be seen how some receive communion or go to confession, but as the occasions arise, the patience of divine life cannot be seen in them. Sorry, but as occasions arise, in other words, things challenge them, you can see that the divine life isn't there. In other words, they're not patient or kind in their reaction to trials. Okay. And if patience is missing, love is missing, because love is recognized only through sacrifice. Hasn't every parent learned that the hard way? You know, you start out in a relationship in marriage, and then you bring these children into the world, and it's sacrifice from that day onwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the strange thing is that the love grows and blossoms and blossoms and blossoms with it. So here are the doubts. While the cross, patience and resignation are fruits produced only by grace and by love. So the cross produces permanent results, but people can go to communion one day in good dispositions and another day in not good dispositions. So March the 9th, 1908, the lives of all palpitated in the heart of Jesus. We were all present in him. He is the man and we're all part of him. That, of course, is your 1 Corinthians 12, isn't it? The body of Christ. Continue in my usual state, Louisa said. Blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he seemed to draw near me, letting me hear the beats of his heart, but they were very strong. And many other little heartbeats palpitated in his heart. So notice his own strong heartbeat, and then many others as well. He told me, my daughter, this is the state in which my heart found itself in the act of my passion. All human lives palpitated in my heart. Now, in the hours of the passion, in the prayer in Gethsemane, when he said, Father, let this chalice pass from me, he said he had taken all the difficulties and all the refusals and absolutely everything of the whole human race, and he was giving them back to God. And then he was saying, but not my will, but thine. He was redeeming it. He was redeeming our refusals all the time. Now, that's not the only explanation. There are several explanations. So all human lives palpitated in my heart, which with their sins were all in the attitude of giving me death. And my heart, in spite of their ingratitude, taken by violence of love, gave back life to all. Now, I want to give you Matthew 11:12 there. Taken by violence of love, because that's where he sweated blood, isn't it? Matthew 11:12 says, the kingdom of God suffers violence and the violent take it by force. So we don't have a picture of Jesus taking the kingdom of God by force in Gethsemane, do we? That's what he was doing. He was taking it off Satan, because Satan had told him, all the kingdoms of the earth are mine, didn't he? Okay. So this is why I palpitated so strongly. And in my heart, I enclosed all human heartbeats, making them rise again into heartbeats of grace, love and divine light. And then he disappeared. In addition to this, having spent a day with many visitors, we would say, because she doesn't visit anybody, I was feeling tired. And in my interior, I was lamenting to our Lord, saying, move creatures away from me. I feel very oppressed. I don't know what they find or want in me. Have pity on the violence I do to myself continuously, to be with you in my interior and with creatures externally. Now look at that. Just look at that for a minute. That while there are people all around her and she's dealing with them, she's trying to keep the open communication with the Lord going on. That nothing would exhaust you more. It's incredible. At that moment, the Queen Mother came and raising her right hand, pointing to my interior in which there seemed to be beloved Jesus. Naturally, he was there. She told me, my beloved daughter, do not oppress yourself. Creatures can only run to where there is treasure. In other words, Louisa was already drawing attention just from what the priests were saying. And naturally enough, most human beings are so lost that if somebody says they know where to go, they'll follow you. And since in you there is the treasure of sufferings in which my sweet son is enclosed, they come to you. So, however, while dealing with them, do not get distracted from your treasure, which of course is being in contact with Jesus, making each one love and the treasure that you contain within you. That's Matthew 16:24. And that treasure is the cross of my son. In this way, you will send them back all enriched. So I want to give you Mark 10:21. Mark 10:21. Galatians 6:14. And Hebrews 12:2. So, the people are coming looking for something from Louisa. They actually don't know what they're looking for. They're simply like moths to a light. And so Blessed Mother is saying what is actually attracting them is the cross. And let them go away having touched your treasure, but without you losing yours. You know, have you ever tried to help somebody who is really distressed and they go off great and you're as heavy as lead when they're gone? And what has happened is they've transferred their weight onto you. And you forgot that while you were dealing with them, that you should have been passing it on, giving it to the only burden bearer we have, which is Jesus. And so we've all made that mistake. And so if you feel more oppressed having helped somebody else, you've internalized their problems instead of passing them on to the Lord. Whereas if you had consciously passed them on to the Lord, then the person goes out light. Why? Because they've experienced the Lord. They've experienced him through you much more powerfully than the other way. Is that okay? That's the advice of our Blessed Lady, which I think is wonderful. She's a very practical mother, isn't she? So let's do March 13th, 1908. The warmth of the union which Jesus dispels from the soul and the cold of human inclinations. You know, in these writings, you keep on comparing Jesus himself and the love of God also with the sun, the source of warmth and light. Okay, so here, instead of using the image of the sun, just the warmth. While I was in my usual state, a demon came who did strange things. But as soon as he disappeared, I no longer thought about it. Isn't that incredible control of your thoughts? To the point of forgetting about his strange behaviour, occupying myself with my highest and only good. So that's your 2 Corinthians 10:5 put into practice. She has succeeded in capturing every thought. Now, for us, curiosity would make us look at what the demon was doing and trying to describe it, and we would try to tell other people about it, and we might even tell other people we had this interesting experience, which is rather interesting, which tells you that we're at a much, much lower level than her. But she just let him do whatever shenanigans he was doing and then moved on. Later, however, a thought came to me. How bad and insipid I am. Nothing makes an impression on me. I mean, that's lovely. And blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, there are certain regions in which the plants are not subject to cold, frost and snow, and therefore they're not stripped of their leaves, flowers and fruits. That's, of course, not Ireland, is it? And if they take some breaks, it is for a short time, so that when their fruits are picked, there may be the necessary time for others to grow. Now, of course, if you think of the Holy Land where Jesus came from, they had 2 harvests a year. They always said it was 4 months to harvest because they had such fantastic weather. In fact, warmth fecundates them in an admirable way, and they're not subject to slowness as the plants in the cold regions. These poor plants, because of frost and snow, for long months are subject to producing very few fruits and for a very short time, almost tiring the patience of the farmer who has to pick them. So there you are. So the heading for the next paragraph is Souls in Union with God. And what are you going to be talking about? The warmth and the fecundity. Such are the souls who have reached union with me. The warmth of my union dispels from them the cold of human inclinations, which, like the cold, renders them sterile and stripped of leaves and divine fruits. Now, the divine fruits is Galatians 5:20. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and all the rest. The frosts of passions and snows of disturbances, they block the fruits of grace in the soul. Look at the way the Lord is able to use these images in many different ways to get across a point to us. But since they remain in the shadow of their union with me, nothing makes an impression on them anymore. So isn't he explaining to Louisa why she paid no attention to that demon? Okay. Nothing enters into their interior, which may disturb our union and our rest. Now, I want to take the word rest. Very important. It's a very important word in the Bible. I want to give you Hebrews 4:10. Well, I should have given you Hebrews 3:18 first. Zephaniah, Z-E-P-H, 3:17. And Isaiah 63:14. So entering into rest. Now I haven't given you all the references in the Bible at all. There's dozens of them. Because entering into your rest is the symbol of coming out of the wilderness and into the promised land. So it's the symbol of entering into heaven. Therefore, it's the symbol of union with God. So I have to give you there as well, Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap, totally content, resting in the mother's love. Okay. So Jesus explained to Louisa why that demon couldn't distract her, because she is in this place of union with him, and the Lord wouldn't allow anything to disturb our union. So you need to sort of put some kind of a marker. I put a ring around special words, our, a ring around them. It's our union. That is you and me. It's not you by yourself. and our rest. The whole of their lives turns within my centre. In other words, you're resting in God. Oh, I should give you Psalm 62 as well. I know if I better stop that because it'll be going on and on for the rest of the night. Rest in God, my soul, is Psalm 62. So their inclination, their passion is for God. And if sometimes there's a little break, it's nothing but a simple hiding of myself in order to give them the surprise of greater consolations and therefore be able to enjoy in them more delicious fruits of patience and of heroism. Now, this is where Louisa has to learn that these privations of the Lord is him hiding. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure you played hide and seek with small children, did you? And it was the joy of finding is what the game was about. Okay. One of the things I've always loved about small children playing hide and seek is if they went behind the sofa, they made sure they had a foot out so you could see them. And in reading many of the testimonies of Louisa long before volume 8, you're talking about volume 3 to 5, I think it is, she sometimes says that he isn't coming at all. And then she sees his hand. To me, that's the hide and seek game. He's saying, I'm here. You just don't see me. So the patience and the heroism that they've exercised during my hiding. Now, the next paragraph is about imperfect souls who have not reached this union. So things are going to be a bit different. All the opposite for the imperfect souls. They really seem like plants born in the cold regions. Oh, dear. That's us. They are subject to all the impressions, and so their lives live more from impressions than from reason and virtue. Oops. Inclinations, passions, temptations, disturbances, and all the events of life are like colds, snows, frosts, and hails, which prevent the development of my union with them. And when it seems that they have had a beautiful flowering, a new failure, something that upsets them is enough to make this beautiful flowering wither and fall to the ground. So they're always at the beginning. They produce very few fruits and they almost tire my patience in cultivating them. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So I'll give you one more because it's about storms and we can't leave the subject and come back to it on another day. Do you know what I mean? It's better to complete a subject. So March the 15th, 1908, when souls are all filled with God, storms have no strength to agitate them even slightly. Is that a most wonderful statement? now he's going to give the image of the sea, that you have a storm on the surface, but if you go down to the depths of the sea, it's all calm, isn't it? So this morning I was feeling more than ever oppressed because of the privation of my highest and only good. But at the same time, I was placid without those anxieties that used to make me go round through heaven and earth. And only when I would find him would I stop. So I was saying to myself, what a change. I feel petrified from the pain of your absence and yet I don't cry. Philippians 4:7, the peace that passes all understanding. I feel a profound peace that invests me completely. So she's experiencing the peace that passes all understanding. Not a contrary breath enters into me. At that moment, blessed Jesus came and he told me, my daughter, do not want to trouble yourself. Notice, don't put your will into it. You must know that when there is a strong storm at the sea, where the waters are deep, the storm is only superficial. Okay. So I've told you before a number of times that when we give spiritual direction and a person is going through a difficult time, we say, is the disturbance on the outside or the inside? If the disturbance is on the outside, no probs. You have problems if it's on the inside. So the depths of the sea are in the most perfect calm. The waters remain tranquil and the fish, when they detect the storm, go to nest where the water is deeper and where it will be safe. So the whole storm unloads itself where the sea contains very little water, which I think is just the surface. Because since there is little water, the storm has the strength to agitate it from top to bottom. and even to transport it where to points other parts of the sea. That's waves taken in completely different directions and all the rest of it. So the next paragraph is souls filled with God. So it happens to souls when they are completely filled with God, up to the brim, up to overflowing outside. That overflowing outside is John 7, 37 to 39. Your own heart, fountains of living water will come out of your heart. Remember that? Storms have no strength to upset them even slightly, because there's no strength that can defy God. At the most, they will feel it superficially. Even more, as the soul detects the storm, she puts the virtues in order. In other words, she gets a grip on herself, okay? And goes to nest in the deepest depths of God. Psalm 62. Psalm 131. So, while externally there seems to be a storm, it is completely false. It is then that the soul enjoys more peace and rests tranquil in the bosom of God, just like the fish in the bottom of the sea. It's a very simple image, isn't it? So the heading for the next paragraph is souls empty of God, and it's going to be all the opposite. All the opposite for the souls who are empty of God or contain just a little bit of God. Storms agitate them all over. In other words, they're upset outside and inside. And if they have a little bit of God, they waste it. Nor does it take strong storms to agitate them. The slightest wind is enough to make virtues flee from them. This is somebody blowing their top, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Even more, holy things themselves, which form a delicious pasture for those former souls who enjoy them to their fill, for these souls turn into storms. Now, this is the fuss people can make over bits of liturgy and who does what and who stands where and who should be standing wherefore and who should be doing what and where. And they drive themselves and everybody else crazy. I know lots of them, do you?
Yes.
Yeah. Matthew 7, 24 to 27. Is the house on the rock or the house on the rocks? And one of the sayings that we've used for a long time is that Jesus doesn't want Christians on the rocks. Okay. So even holy things can turn you into storms. I'm sure you've never heard anybody burst out in anger about somebody in a church. I have. They are knocked about by all winds. Remember Matthew 11, 7, Jesus said that John the Baptist was not a reed blowing in the wind. Remember? These folks are knocked about by all the winds. From no side is it ever dead calm from there for them, because reason demands that where the whole of God is not present, the inheritance of peace is far away from them. He is the Prince of Peace. Oh, I forgot that. I forgot that one from Colossians. He is our peace. It's in Colossians. Paul says he is our peace. Okay. Look that one up the next. Every single time I come to these, I get more scriptures.